Julan Mate is a researcher at the University of Lausanne and originally from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He is the director of the Great
Yes,
Lakes.
let's move.
That's He is the director of the Great Lakes Peace Initiative Center, which is a platform for African intellectuals to play their part in contributing to putting an end to the humanitarian tragedy in the Great Lakes region and put forth ideas for a sustainable future. He is here today to speak about his work and his contribution to New Research Voices, Researchers in Exile. His article is called Fieldwork, Risk Management and Challenging Security Environments, a Chronological Story of Investigating Rebel Governance in North Kivu. So, Gulan, can you tell us a little bit about your life in the DRC before you became a researcher in exile?
Yes, okay. In my country, I was just a scholar. I studied my university information in the DRC, especially in the Kivu region, in the eastern part of the country. Yes, and I started my university studies in a private university called Université Catholique du Cap-Vert in my native city of Butembo. And then, when I was doing my my first thesis at university, this produced a clash with local actors. I mean, the Catholic clergy itself, because the work was dealing with the role played by the clergy, the Catholic clergy, in the conflict and peace process in the region. So after this clash with the clergy, I had to flee from my native region and to go to pursue my studies in another city of the country called Kisangani, at the Kisangani University, where I had the opportunity to pursue my master's studies. And this was in 2004, and 2 years after I had the chance to finish my master's studies at the University of Kisangani. And then I came back home in Butembo. When I arrived in Butembo back from Kisangani, I decided to pursue other inquiries I was conducting before leaving. In the framework of my human rights work, I mean, I was searching about some massacres that took place in this region, and for which I consider myself as a survivor and my family as well. But I lost some family members as well, and many friends in my area. And then, when I was going back to these inquiries, they arised once again. The memories of the clash that took place 2 years before, and then I was targeted again by these actors, so I had to flee again from this area to another region again, within the Congo. The region is called Sud Kivu, South Kivu region, in the city of Bukavu, and there I had the chance to be appointed as a lecturer at the University of Bukavu, at the Faculty of Political Science of the University of Bukavu, where I started teaching. And then, unfortunately, it was not enough to be free from these threats and attacks from different actors. I mean, not only the clergy, but also some armed actors, because these massacres I was investigating, there are many actors involved. There are especially armed forces, former rebellions, big men of the rebellions, and in relationship with some social actors, to mean actors of civil society. So at a certain moment it was not possible to stay in Bukavu, so I had to struggle in order to find a way to flee from the region. And fortunately, I had a friend living in France who told me about the program Scholar Rescue Fund, which is based in New York, which is a program of the IIE, International Institute of Education. And this has a program called Scholar Rescue Fund that provides scholarships to threatened scholars. So I got in touch with this this program, and fortunately my application was successful and I was awarded a scholarship from the Scholar Rescue Fund. And thanks to this Scholar Rescue Fund, I was able to flee from the Congo to go to pursue my research in Senegal first, in Dakar. Yeah. And this is the context in which I fled from my native country, the Congo.
And how did you end up in Switzerland then?
Okay, so I spent 1 year in Dakar in Senegal, where I was hosted by the West African Research Center, which is a center of the University of Boston that is implanted in Dakar in Senegal. And there I was working in a project called West African Peace Initiative Project. And then after 1 year, I was entrusted with a program based in Abidjan in Cote d'Ivoire in order to pursue my specialization in conflict management and peace building. And thanks to the scholarship from the Scholar Rescue Fund, I was able to move from Dakar to Cote d'Ivoire and to pursue my specialization there. And in 2011, I was lucky to be to achieve this this specialization, my DSS formation. And when I was preparing my specialization thesis, unfortunately, there were a new clash in Cote d'Ivoire due to the political tumult, the post-electoral political tumults in the country in 2010, following the next year. So in this context, it was, again, impossible for me to stay in Cote d'Ivoire. I mean, I was like... I was like in between two fires.
Okay.
Not only I couldn't stay in Cote d'Ivoire because of these political tumults, but also I couldn't go back home in my country because war was still going on. So, and what was difficult in this context was that my scholarship has ended as well. My two years scholarship from the Scholar Rescue Fund has ended. So thanks to my contacts there in the network, I came to get in touch with the Scholars at Risk Network, this which is based in at the University of New York, and which was, I was lucky that they were very receptive to my situation, and then they worked out on my case and arranged a position, a research position at the University of Lausanne, which is a member of the Scholars at Risk Network, and this was just the big luck I had to be invited at the University of Lausanne as a visiting researcher from March of 2011
to present, where you're finishing your PhD there at the moment. Yes,
of course, but I came just as a visiting researcher here at the University of Lausanne, but yes, the first I had to work about on my doctoral project, and I was. It was at the beginning. It was difficult to get, to be registered at the University of Lausanne as a PhD student, and my first university affiliation as a PhD student was the University of Basel here in Switzerland.
Okay.
Yes, but 1 year after the beginning of my doctoral studies at Basel, I had some difficulties in getting funding for pursuing my doctoral research. And then, yes, I was really lucky that the direction of the University of Lausanne had agreed to take back my project and to appoint me as a teaching assistant at the University of Lausanne in order to allow me pursue my doctoral research. And at the same time, I was applying here and there for scholarships, and also I was lucky to get again the scholarship from the Gerda Hengel Stiftung Foundation in Germany, in German. And to mean that my position at the University of Lausanne was funded half by the support, the assistance from the University of Lausanne, and half from my scholarship got in Germany.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. So you brought up something there at the start about the role of the Catholic clergy, which I really want to get into. But before we get into that, can you give us some background on the conflict in the DRC? Because I think in the Western media, it's not covered very much, and people aren't very aware of one of Africa's longest and bloodiest conflicts. So if you could give us just a little background on the conflict there, how it started, I mean, what are the roots of it, and what is its position at the moment? I mean, are we in a time of peace, or what's happening?
Yes, briefly speaking, it's about difficult cohabitation between local communities. On the one hand, we have communities that are originally from Rwanda, which is a neighboring country, and at the other hand, we had those who call themselves autochthon communities of North Kivu.
Okay.
And the issue has started from the colonial era, you know. From the colonial epoch, colonialists has started to organize immigration movements from Rwanda, of people from Rwanda to the Kivu, in order to work in their firms.
Okay, and was it rubber mining in North Kivu, or was it diamond mining, or what was the?
Both of them.
Both
it was
them, okay.
For mining as well as mine mineral sites. Yeah. So yes, this movement of populations from Rwanda to the Kivu. Has increased the tensions and pressure between those who call themselves autochthon communities and those immigrated from Rwanda. And apart from this, after the independence of the DRC in 1996, this movement continued, this movement of populations continued to immigrate at all the sides of the border, from Rwanda to the Congo and from Congo to the Rwanda. Many came as refugees as the result of political tumults in Rwanda since the 50s. Others came in just normal movements from Rwanda to the Congo, to the Congo as normal immigrants. Let's say like that. But also, what we need to mention here is that there are also other communities which are called Rwandophone. That means those speaks the Kinyarwanda language that were instead that were living in Kyiv even before independence.
Okay.
So these populations immigrated from Rwanda during the colonial era, came to mix with those speaking Kinyarwanda who were living on this in this place since long years, and it created some a kind of confusion.
Mm-hmm.
And at a certain moment, those communities that pretend to be indigenous communities were feeling like they was invested, they were spoliated, their lands, because they were mainly invested in agricultural activities, while these populations, mainly from the Tutsi community,
mm-hmm.
were, how do we call them, les éleveurs, who had got animals just to,
mm-hmm.
they are all farms, I think, in English. So,
okay.
They who have animals, let's say, to
mm-hmm.
to breed animals, let's
yeah.
say.
Okay.
So it created a clash between these two communities with different cultures about cohabitation, about around many issues, let's say, access to the land
mm-hmm.
and economical activities as well.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in the period following the independence of the Congo, these local conflicts were manipulated by the Congolese regime.
Mm-hmm.
They were manipulated in the way that at a certain moment they provide a collective citizenship to these populations immigrated from Rwanda. Ten years after, they withdrew this citizenship to these populations, and this was very dangerous in terms of managing this conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And while after some years, these communities were feeling like they were excluded
mm-hmm.
and neglected. Neglected by local communities and excluded from the national community, although they were considering themselves as Congolese citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1996, these communities took advantage of the political change in Rwanda in 1994 after the genocide
mm-hmm.
to be backed by the new Rwandan regime in order to discover their nationality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the war in 1996 were conducted officially to fight against the dictatorship of Mobutu Sese Seko in the Congo.
Mm-hmm.
But this war was labeled to be the Banyarwanda Revolution, because they were the one who were the majority of the fighters were from the Banyarwanda communities and
mm-hmm.
were motivated by the ambition to solve problems around their citizenship and about their access to the land and to other resources
mm-hmm.
at the same level as those who call themselves local communities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So at the heart of it, you have a really an ethnic nationalist conflict.
We have a very important ethnic dimension
mm.
in this conflict, but it will be reductionist
mm-hmm.
to read this only as an ethnic conflict.
Okay.
We have a mix of many issues.
Mm.
Let's say at the local level you have an ethnic issue, but what is again complicated to understand is the issue the issues at stake for the involvement of foreign countries in this conflict, which played also a role in this conflict, a major role in this conflict. Let's say Rwanda, Uganda, and Burundi, the neighboring countries first, and also transnational actors as well. At a point, and we in 1998, the conflict was were just transformed. It was just a conflict that were launched by security issues at first, but which were transformed in which were we recognized more and more that these were an economical conflicts as well.
Okay, so you have these, you brought up the transnational companies, and what is their involvement, or what was their involvement in the conflict?
Yes, we have all the reports from the UN group of experts that depicts all different multinational companies, mostly from the West and also from some African countries, which were involved in this conflict in order to get an easy access to mineral resources in that region. And you know, this region is we have much mineral resources in this region. I will just depict one of them. I don't know if you have heard about talking about coltan. Yes, coltan is a very precious mineral resource which exists mostly in this part of the world. It is said that the Congo, the Eastern Congo, has about 60% of coltan in the world. So I think this is one among the motives of this conflict, which
And
is
it, it
not
yeah.
talked too much about.
And it's used in the mobile phone industry, isn't it? This mineral.
Exactly, it's used in mobile phone industries and in aerospace industries as well.
Okay, so something that's in huge demand, obviously, in the West. Around the world, not just the
Yes,
West, everywhere.
absolutely, absolutely. We are living now in an informatic revolution, and without coltan, there is no informatic revolution.
So these transnational companies were somehow complicit in the conflict there. In what way? How were they responsible for what was happening in the conflict?
Yes, basing on the UN reports of expert or the, because the how to say it, the Conseil the Security the Security Council has established has institutionalized a group of experts for the Congo since the beginning of since 1999, I think, or 2000, in order to investigate the relationship between violence in this region and the looting of mineral resources. And we have many reports of this group. Each year they produce a report since 2001. Yes. And if you read this, you will re easily understand the relationship between the easy access to mineral resources and these companies. But it is important to mention that these companies do not operate only with armed conflict. Sometimes they operate also with the officials, even the Congolese official government, in violation of some international norms that have been imposed to the Congo in order to deal with this conflict. I mean the embargo on arms trade.
Okay.
which were imposed to the Congo since the beginning of the 2000s.
So you have these transnational companies creating a demand and working with the militia groups, also with the government officials, playing both sides basically to maybe not encourage the conflict, but certainly not to resolve it in any sense. Is that right?
Yes, of course. Their role is really very, it's very confusing.
Yeah, okay.
It's very confusing. It's really difficult to yes, to know to learn the impact of their role in this conflict. Sometimes they I don't say that all of them
Sure.
are bad intentioned in this the action there, but the impact of the action may be very negative sometimes
Sure.
in the pursuit of this conflict, and some of them do know what they are doing. They are doing that knowing that they are violating some norms and that their actions could contribute to the ongoing conflict. But they are doing so for their economical interest as well.
Of course. Okay, and getting back to the role of the clergy that you brought up earlier. Now you've had some truck with the Catholic clergy, so I'd like to explore that a little bit and what is their role in the conflict and how did it affect you personally?
Okay. I don't think what was very much concerning in my research was really the role they directly played in supporting armed groups. But what was very much concerning, especially for the clergy, was that I was doing a link between the internal conflicts between the clergy and their political position in supporting different actors, different rebels or militias actors. And this, their position in supporting or not supporting these actors were guided by identitarian, especially by identitarian motives.
Of course, okay.
Yes, and this led the clergy to miss many opportunities, many peace opportunities they wanted to achieve in playing in pretending to play a positive role in resolving this conflict.
Okay.
And yes, and in some ways it was even dangerous in some positions took by the clergy in the way that for identitarian motives they were obliged to take position in favor of some armed in favor of some armed groups, some armed leaders that were involved in crimes. And this way, they were being accomplice with by facilitating the work, okay, by supporting these actors which were involved in crimes. I said this is really dangerous because their responsibility can be involved, and of course it was, because in some times they were even facilitating some dialogues between armed militias, between armed local militias, and in some negotiations, some of these negotiations ended in clash. I mean, where one of the militia took in hostage the members of the opposite delegations and killed them. In yes, in the area, in the area privileged by the clergy as an official facilitator. And in this confusion, many of these actors accused the clergy to be accomplices.
Well, their crimes are nothing new. I mean, if we look at their involvement in Rwanda, in the crisis there, or the conflict there, it played out, you know.
Yes. Yes. Shocking. So, talking about these issues, about the confusing role, the confused role of the clergy in the management of this conflict, were interpreted by the clergy as to take part in favor of the opposing groups that are opposed to the non-community to which I belong, because the clergy is majoritarily dominated by this community in my area,
okay,
in opposite to those came, those that came from Rwanda. Mm-hmm. You know, when I told you about the opposition between populations that came from Rwanda and those that call themselves as indigenous communities.
Mm.
Among these indigenous communities, the most important is the Nandi community in North Kivu,
okay,
which represents a half of the population of North Kivu and which is the most powerful. Mm. And this Nandi community, to which I belong as well, occupied two main districts in this North Kivu region. I mean the Beni community and Lubero district, the main Beni and Lubero district, and which is the half of the North Kivu region.
Mm-hmm.
And these are considered as to be the most serious antagonists of the Banyarwanda community.
Okay.
And when criticizing the politics of the clergy in the Nandi community, they accused me directly to take part in favor of the Banyarwanda community, which is the very serious antagonist of the Nandi community.
Okay.
Although I was conducting my research objectively, criticizing the role played by the Catholic clergy, criticizing as well different local conflicts therein, and even in perspective the possible responsibilities that can result in the political the clergy's position in this conflict.
So they tried to tarnish you because you were speaking out against them, basically.
Yes, it's just because they are opposed to the truth. They don't like anybody talk badly, negatively about the action.
Right.
And anybody
I think
who
that's...
comes to criticize the action is directly qualified as a mole of the opposed community, which is called Banyarwanda. And there were many coincidences.
And what do you think is that the heart of the Catholic clergy's reasoning and the reason? Is it basic money that they're after resources that you know that their position was threatened by you and therefore they would lose some resources or some money?
It isn't money as well. Mm-hmm. It's motivations were identitarian and political.
Okay. Okay, but I mean, at the back of all of that, is it you know they're after the money, you know that they want all the
course.
So that's the root of it.
Can have now consequences in terms of facilities to access some resources.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, and what is to be clear with this issue, the Catholic clergy were playing the card of the official government of Kinshasa, while the region was occupied by rebels groups.
Okay.
It means that the power of Kinshasa used the Catholic clergy to destabilize the action of the main rebellions in the East.
Okay.
And And the territory is controlled by these principal rebellions. There are also many different armed groups that are were opposed to these main armed rebellions,
okay,
which are ethnic militias and so on and so forth. And then the role played by the Catholic clergy were to get in touch with these armed militias, mm-hmm, to organize them again, and to organize them against the main rebellions that were controlling this area.
Okay.
And that is the issue. And by doing that, they were saying, the Catholic officially was saying that, okay, we are just interested in peace process and reconcile everybody and so on and so forth. But their position in supporting these armed militias, what I revealed in my research, was that mm-hmm. they were motivated by identitarian motives.
Mm-hmm.
Only it was especially because many of these actors, locally actors, that were involved in these official armed groups
mm-hmm.
were originally from the clans, clan groups, that were different from those in power within the clergy. And it became an intra-ethnic
fight. I see, okay.
It was an intra-ethnic fight between the clergy
mm-hmm.
and those rebellion big man which belonged to the same,
mm-hmm.
most of them which were belonging to the same ethnic group.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what I revealed was that the role played by the clergy, even if officially it is for researching peace, was not only for researching peace, it was also motivated by identitarian motives and also political motives, because many leaders from the Catholic Church were promoted in Kinshasa.
Okay.
As the compensation of the role played by the clergy to destabilize this rebellion. This was my point in my research.
Okay, and just briefly, do you know if the bureaucrats in the Vatican had anything to say about the Congolese Catholic clergy? I mean, did they speak out against their role, or did they just remain silent?
I think the Catholic Church is one of the most closed in the world. It is really much difficult to know what is being decided or discussed.
So they didn't speak out publicly.
It's a closed system.
So they didn't speak out publicly is what I mean.
They don't speak it publicly, but I know they are aware about all of these issues. They know that the role played by some of the clergy members were very nefarious.
Yeah, so they're probably worried about their public relations image.
And were motivated by personal interest rather than only the official interest they were claiming to defend by the action.
Okay, I think we could talk about this for forever. But let's get on a little bit more onto your research. Like during your research, you take us on a kind of a journey where, you know, we meet various people that helped you with your research, and also at one point where you got arrested. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how it kind of impacted on you as a researcher?
Yes. So since 2 years now, since I'm working on my doctoral thesis, yes, I'm now trying to analyze how rebel groups have governed territories under their control. How did they provide public goods? If and how they did provide put in place some institutions of providing good governance somehow in territories under their control in the absence of the official state institutions. This is my point in this research. And when I were doing, when I was doing my my fieldwork research 2 years ago, it was in March and April 2004.
Mm-hmm. 2014. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, 14. Okay. Yeah, and it was. Yes, I decided to go to in places that were ruled by these armed conflicts in order to get the reality on the ground. And I started my research in Goma City because we have to subscribe the context in which this research took place.
Yeah.
It was in March 2014, while the rebellion was militarily defeated in November 2015. 13.
13, yeah. Okay.
Yes. So it was about 4 months after this rebellion had been militarily defeated. And in this, in such a context, the political, especially the security situation was very tense. It was very, very difficult security situation because they were suspecting members of this rebellion that went to get refuge in the neighboring countries, I mean in Rwanda and Uganda, to be organizing again in order to come to yes, to fight and to take again the areas they were controlling. And then when I arrived in Goma, I decided to do every formalities in order to be protected against any threats from the official security agents. And I was basing myself on my networks there because I knew first it was dangerous for me to, I couldn't be free of movement anytime because of my previous background in that region. Yes, so it was. I was really basing mainly to my network of researchers based of human rights defenders, members of my NGO based in Goma and in North Kivu mainly. And they arranged all of these things for me to get some official papers in order to allow me to go to travel to the territories that were controlled by rebellions. I decided as well to work with an assistant, a research assistant that I recruited on the ground, and this one, the recruitment of this one was part of my research because he was also a member, a civilian that worked within the administration of those territories controlled by the rebellions.
Okay.
And the role, I knew it was a kind of risk, but at the same time, it was also very important for my research, you know. And when I was on the ground within those territories, I could get facilities to investigate and to conduct my interviews with many actors because he knew all the places, all the sites, and many actors. It was easy for me to collect as much data as possible.
Sure, I think as a researcher, it's really important for us to work with the local communities anyway, right? So you'd established this network of people working with local people in the region, and you get arrested. Can you tell us how that impacted on your experience as a researcher? I mean, what personal effect did the arrest? I mean, I don't want to go into the reasons for the arrest because that's all in the article, and if people are interested, they can look it up there. But can you just tell us a little bit about how that impacted on you personally to be arrested and its effect on your research?
Yes, I think I was just lucky that. Yes, I could come through this issue because when I was arrested, I thought this was the end of my doctoral research.
Yes, of course. You know, what a frightening experience. And
Yes,
how,
that's.
yeah.
I'm really torn about this issue. You know, it's really difficult for me to answer this. I'm torn because, on the one hand, I say, okay, I'm lucky that security services of the Congo don't work properly. I'm just lucky. Because
Okay.
if they were to work properly, I don't know if I could continue with this research.
Okay.
Because they arrested me with everything I took from the ground. I had my agendas where I was writing my interviews. I had my records, my pictures, my cameras, and so on and so forth.
But you
And when
kept
I
a
was
copy, didn't you, of the SD card with all your data?
Yes, I had everything, even my computer. I had everything with me.
Oh
So
my
when I
gosh.
was arrested, I said, okay, this is the end of my doctoral research. It's just the end of an adventure. But when they took me, yes, when they took me to be questioned, I was just doing whatever they asked me. They asked me money to pay oil for their cars, to pay cards for their communications, to pay water, and so on and so forth. And I was just giving. Giving. Had to negotiate my release, you know.
Sure.
So they found that I was just a really gentleman, and they even didn't try to open my bag. And at
Okay.
that moment, they said, okay, we arrest you, because the reason of my arrest was different of what I was thinking about. I
Yeah.
thought I was arrested at that moment because of my former records in human rights work and research as well in
Yeah.
the Kivu some years ago. But they didn't know who I was.
Okay, so their incompetence really, really, really helped you in
Yeah,
many
so
ways, yeah.
they suspected me to be one of the rebels because I
Right.
was collaborating with them,
Yeah.
or to be a facilitator of the
Sure.
conduct of these rebels in the West in
Sure.
order to facilitate them get access to yes, to funding and so on and so forth. So I had to explain myself and to let them understand that what I was doing was just inscribed in the framework of the researcher, doctoral researcher, and not something else. And then I was lucky that they understood after a long discussion, although I had even official letters that were allowing me to do that research. And then they released me, but they kept my assistant, my research assistant, in the jail,
Yeah, and that's all
which
explained in the article, and your daring escape from the country as well, which is quite a fascinating read, I think. And how did it all result? I mean, what was your research finding at the end of the day after all your experience of being arrested and tried extorted for money and losing your phone and escaping out of the country again? What was your the finding, the main finding of that research for you?
Okay, the main finding is, if I can summarize my finding are that rebel armed groups, by analyzing rebel armed groups, we have to go beyond the criminal register that lead many organizations, many civil society organizations, and even the UN shift to cope with this armed group. I mean, although armed groups and rebellions cause many suffering to the local populations, but I think these armed groups, they are not per se the factors of destroying state institutions.
Okay.
Because in many circumstances in the Kivu reality, these rebellions were reproducing the state in territory, the state institutions, and performing even them in the absence of official institutions of the state.
Okay, so they're kind of substituting the state in many ways.
Yes, yeah, so in order to build sustainable peace in post-conflict settings, I think it is really important for peace builders, both national and international peace builders, to be considering what kind of institutions emerged in territories under the rebels' control, what worked within these areas and what didn't work, and how they can do to improve or to change what was done in this area. But it is a mistake to think that, yes, everything is bad.
Okay, and do you think we can work with the rebel groups then to build a sustainable development or to build a sustainable future? Do you think that the authorities should work with these rebel groups?
I don't think they have to work with these rebel groups as the opposite of the country.
Okay.
But in the process of reconciliation, in the process of peace building, they have to take into consideration what is positive in rebels' actions, in political action of these rebels on territories controlled by them.
Okay.
Because many times those things we blame for rebels on territories under their control in terms of human rights violations and so on, many, or even looting of resources and so on, many times these same facts are true for the official government, unfortunately.
Okay. Okay. And what's your hope for the future of the DRC now?
Unfortunately, I'm obliged to cut my contact with the DRC now.
Okay.
Because in this context, it is really difficult for me to go back home.
Yeah,
and when I came back here in Switzerland after this research, I was obliged to apply for an asylum status, and what I have obtained 1 year before, 1 year ago, since February of last year, I have been awarded a refugee status here in Switzerland, and it was mainly because I came to realize that it isn't time for me to go back home. With the experience of the research I conducted 2 years ago. Because since my arrival here in Switzerland in 2011, I hadn't never applied for asylum or refugee status here. Yeah. I was hoping that everything will improve and I will go back home after my doctoral studies here. But when I went to the field in 2014,
you got arrested.
And experiencing all of those stuff, I came back and I decided to apply to asylum.
And do you think in the future the situation in the DRC will stabilize? Do you think that there is a future for the country?
I'm still keeping hope that things will improve, but of course, many work still remains to be done. In order to improve the situation, because I had the impression that not a big thing has changed since all these years I were in exile.
Yeah,
okay. This was my impression when I went back for my fieldwork research. But I'm still closed to the evolution of the situation, even from a brat, and I'm still acting as well as human rights defender from here. I'm still keeping hope that we can have significant change in the Congo that can accelerate even the changing of the situation in the eastern part of the Congo. Because as I see the situation, it's a problem of goodwill, mainly of goodwill of the actors, not only the national actors, but also international actors involved in this conflict. We need to get to, yes, to take a step, a determined step, in order to put an end to this situation. And I still keeping hope that the time will come. The time will come that policymakers will gather together as one and put an end to this conflict.
Okay, thank you very much.